Thank you, Tim. And the Ann Arbor District Library is certainly one of my favorite community institutions, too. So let's give a round of thanks for the library. And thank you all for coming here today. Thank you for remembering to silence your devices. There's a Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart, who said the only prayer you ever need, the only prayer you ever said was thank you, that would be enough. So thank you to the library. Thank you to you. Thank you also to the volunteers who helped organize this, our panelists for coming to speak, and to our committee chair for our Climate Change and Earth Care Committee, Jan Wright, and the other members of that task force. As Tim said, my name is Chuck Warpahusky. I have the honor of serving as the director of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. When Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice was started back in 1965, it was when people from different faiths and backgrounds came together in response to the war in Vietnam. They recognized that they all had calls to be peacemakers, and they would both be more effective if they worked together across their differences, and that very act of coming together across differences, that in itself is an act of peacemaking. Over the last 50 years that ICBJ has been around, that concept of how do we come together across our differences to make a difference animates all that we do. And when we were thinking about how can we focus our work around this 50th anniversary year, the issue of food and justice really seemed to be the right issue. People were excited about it, and we saw that all of the issues that we work on can have some way that they get that are touched by these issues of food. If we're talking about war, war causes hunger, hunger can cause war. There's a food connection with issues of peace. We're talking about economic justice, working conditions for our workers. If we're talking about care for our environment, that's a huge part. So in addition to bringing different people together across their differences, we saw this theme of food injustice as a chance to bring different issues, different sort of silos together and say, food touches all of these issues. And the other thing is it touches all of our lives. We have an ability to work for a more just world every time we pick up our fork. And that's one of the other reasons we chose food injustice as our theme for this year. And I hope you all picked up the cards that list the events that are scheduled for this spring. We have an amazing lineup. We have panel discussions, educational events like this. We've got bus tours. We've got cooking classes. It's an incredible lineup. Tim mentioned how the library does that work with partners. A lot of this work is through a network of amazing community partners. So I hope you'll continue to be part of the process as we move forward. We've got some amazing, amazing things lined up. To make sure and to encourage you to sign up and to get involved, as the panelists give their remarks, I'll also be passing around clipboards so that you can find out more about what we're doing. You can find out about the other events. Also, I understand that some of the panelists, will be sending you copies of their materials so that you can stay informed about that. Just to give you a sense of how tonight's event is going to take place, we have a variety of panelists from different faith traditions. I'll be introducing them as they come up. They'll each have opening remarks, about 8 minutes for each faith tradition, to lay out a little bit about how they see the connection between these issues of food and justice and sustainability from their own personal lens and from their own faith traditions. After that, we'll have time for some question and answers with the audience. We'll have volunteers circulating in the room to hand out and collect index cards so that you can write your questions on that. So those will come up to me and we'll field questions there. One of the things I love about the library, having events at the library, is they never let us go too long. We have to be... Some of you are laughing. You've been at those events. We have to be out the doors by 9. So we'll be wrapping up here around 8:45, and you'll be able to enjoy the rest of your evening. So, with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first panelist. Our first panelist is Kathy Muha. What animated Kathy to get involved with food justice and food sustainability issues is when she started having young bodies to nourish. And she started getting involved, how do I provide healthy food for my kids? And got involved with food co-op buying when options weren't there, getting involved with farmers markets. And then about 5 years ago, through her congregation, the First Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Ann Arbor, Kathy became the co-chair of the Mindful Eating Coalition, which works with their congregation and the broader community to help people understand these issues of food justice and human health for animals, for the planets, for the food workers, and the environment. They, too, have many great events. I'm sure Kathy will tell you a little bit about that. And a couple of years ago, Kathy also got involved with the Washtenaw Food Council and the Food Access and Nutrition Policy Action Team, so that in addition to helping people make individual decisions about food and justice, helping look at how businesses and our government actions can set policies that magnify that impact even further. So I'm looking forward so much to hearing what Kathy has to say. Kathy.
Thank you, Chuck. And thank you, ICPJ, for inviting me and letting me be part of this wonderful panel. So we were asked three questions. The first one was on the environment. And so in order to answer those questions so that you can understand what the Unitarian Universalist congregation, both across the nation and in our particular church, what we do with those things. I looked up some things. There is a covenant of seven principles that the UUA, that's Unitarian Universalist Association, goes by. And I looked at that and fit that with each of our questions about environment and workers' rights and so on. And then I also looked at the 2011 Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience. That was Chuck was referring to. There was a study that was done across the nation by Unitarian Universalist groups to study food and what is ethical about it and what is mindful about it. And then what's called a statement of conscience, which is about a 6-page document, was outlined. And so I pulled from that document items, too, so that I can tell you what, on a national level, the Unitarians are doing. So as far as food and the environment, the covenant that I picked out was respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And from the Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience, I pulled these quotes. With gratitude for the food we have received, we strive to choose foods that minimize harm and are protective of the environment, consumers, farmers, and all those involved in food production and distribution. Environmental justice includes the equitable distribution of both environmental burdens and benefits for populations of residents and workers. Marginalized people have often been able to find housing or work only in areas exposed to environmental pollutants, with consequent negative health and quality of life effects. Environmental concerns include the use of fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and hormones, and high volumes of animal waste produced by CAFOs, all of which can contaminate soil, air, and water. Contributors to global warming include the over-reliance on fossil fuels for food production, the methane produced by animals, including but not limited to cattle, sheep, and pigs, and the long-distance transport of food. Expanding agriculture and animal farming often removes natural habitats and reduces natural biodiversity. An additional environmental concern is the deterioration of the oceans and their life forms due to overfishing and pollution. And the action suggested in the environmental the Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience is that each church provide and sell more plant-based, organic, locally produced, and fair trade foods at congregational events. Our church, the Ann Arbor Unitarian Universalist Church, we have tried to stress local foods. We had a group called Locavores that has sort of morphed into our mindful eating team. But we try to stress local foods. We give information to our congregation on farmers markets and where they are and how to get there. We encourage plant-based foods we have a tasting table every first Sunday of every month where the mindful eating group makes things out, usually with plant-based foods, to show people that they can be tasty. And usually they are based on the season, so that people are buying seasonal food. And then we have wonderful potlucks that are almost all plant-based potlucks. So the second question we were asked was about workers' and farmers' rights, the hourly wages for farm workers, and so on. And the two covenants that I picked out that the Unitarian Universalists share is the inherent worth and dignity of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And from the Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience, this: concerns about the fair treatment of food and farm workers include low pay, poor and unsafe working conditions, exploitation of undocumented workers, and enslavement of others. There's a congregational action suggested in the Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience, which is to engage in direct action in solidarity with workers and labor advocacy groups to support agriculture and food workers. And in our own church, we have a series of events called Meet Your Farmer, where we allow people to have a chance to hear from the local people who produce their foods. Usually they're organic farms and almost always small farms. We just had one a couple weeks ago with a really good turnout. It was Frog Holler Farm. And in February 22nd, we're having one from the Community Farm of Ann Arbor. Ann Elder will be speaking. We also stress fair trade. We have a fair trade group in our church that sells after each service during social hour, sells only fair trade items. And we have worked with ROC, which is the Restaurant Opportunities Center. They're based in Detroit. We read a book together called Behind the Kitchen Door, and had speakers from ROC come and speak to us. And the third item that we have talked about, or that we are talking about tonight, is hunger and food insecurity. The covenants that I would refer to would be, again, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. So from the Ethical Eating Statement of Conscience, it says this: access to an adequate supply of healthy food and clean water is a basic human need and right. Many people do not have adequate food, while others have a surplus. In many locations, poor distribution of food is a major contributor to hunger and malnutrition. The effects of climate change, weather conditions, and armed conflicts can also expose many people to starvation. Paradoxically, an abundance of food does not guarantee access to healthy food. We acknowledge that aggressive action needs to be taken that will ensure an adequate food supply for the world population. The congregational action that they suggest is to promote economic accessibility to safe, ethically produced food by organizing members to work for food justice through activities such as urging grocery chains to locate stores at low-income neighborhoods, supporting local food co-ops, helping people obtain food stamps, advocating for increased funding to alleviate hunger, and assisting local Meals on Wheels and food bank programs. In our church, we are doing quite a few things for hunger issues. The biggest one, I think, is our Food Gatherers Farm Project. We work with a farmer that's right around the corner from our church. Actually, Food Gatherers approached us and said that Farmer Bill was becoming, he had been quite a donator to them of fresh fruits and vegetables over the years, and was becoming unable to do that and needed help. So they approached us, and we have for 3 years now, for three summers, that and a couple other really great things. That was 8 minutes? Okay, ask me more later when there's question time.
Thank you, Kathy. One of the things I really appreciate about what Kathy shared is she talked about how with her congregation they've been bringing in some of these educational opportunities. For example, at the Restaurant Opportunity Center in Detroit, they are a great organization both here in Michigan and actually around the country. One of the things that Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice is doing as part of our spring programming on food injustice is organizing a bus tour to go down. They've got a restaurant where they do some training. They also do amazing food justice, worker justice programs. We'll be tying that into some, you know, on the bus you'll be able to learn about food issues here in the county, visiting other Detroit organizations that are doing amazing on the ground work to make for a more just and more healthy food system. So again, you'll find more about that on the table and back It's a great way to continue the educational experience. And one more reason to sign, I believe the clipboards are now making their way around. So please sign up on those clipboards so that you can keep learning about these opportunities. Our next speaker is the Reverend Kristen Regal. She's an ordained minister of Word and Sacrament in the Presbyterian Church of the United States of America. She currently is serving at First Presbyterian Church of Ann Arbor as a Lilly resident minister. A lot of what Kristen does there is on Christian education, discipleship formation, and the building of a just, loving, and sustainable community. I really appreciate that the focus on a sustainable community as she sees as part of her pastoral work, because it's something that a lot of us are still learning the need to incorporate that into our faith community lives. In addition to serving as a pastor over at First Presbyterian, she lives at an intentional community at Ann Arbor Friends Meetings Quaker House, and has been really doing amazing work within her congregation on these issues of food injustice. So please welcome Reverend Kristen Reed.
Well, thank you to ICPJ and the other panelists. It's really great to be able to be here to learn and to talk with you. For me, some of my earliest memories of food and faith involved growing up in a small rural church in Western New York. I'd like to say it was the sacrament of communion where I first felt God, but more often than not, it was the cookies in the fellowship hall afterwards as I'd run to be the first one in line. For me, church was a place where I could see food and faith, where I could taste it, where I could engage in conversation around potlucks and tables filled with Jello of every shape, size, and color you could imagine. I've always known that I liked food. I've always known that I've loved being in community, which for me has often been in the church. But I am relatively new to learning about how food and justice intersect. So I'm thankful for this opportunity to be here tonight. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Christian tradition and how I understand some of the scriptures and mandates and opportunities that our faith presents, and some of the actions that First Pres has taken to try to live into being a more loving and just community here in Ann Arbor, locally, as well as within the larger denomination. So the food that we eat, how we eat, who we eat it with, the many hands that have touched the food before it ever arrives at our table are all things that we've been thinking about at First Pres. This past fall, we had the opportunity to partner with ICPJ to do a food and faith class where we were able to both visit farms and local food producers to meet the people and hear the stories of the people who are doing the work of producing food, as well as to share our own thoughts and questions about what does it mean to be Christians, to be people who are following Christ, as well as consumers and people who are engaged in the community. What does social justice look like for all of us? So I'm going to start with the first question, which was about the environment. We know most scientists agree that global warming is happening and that the food choices that we make have a great impact on the environment. Agricultural water use and land use has a large impact on the environment and is affecting everything from water supplies to issues of pollution and toxins being put into the earth and into the air. As a Christian, I believe that we are called to be stewards of this good creation that God has created. I think when we look at the creation stories in Genesis, we are told that Adam, or the first human, was created from the adamah, from the land, from the topsoil, from the earth, that our connection to creation is very intimate, and that we are called to love God's creation by being good stewards, by being people who care for and protect and honor that gift with gratitude. One of the things that I appreciate is that in the Presbyterian Church, and one of the things that we understand is it's not just people and humanity who are called to be redeemed and reconciled, but it's all of creation that groans and that is seeking to be made whole, that is seeking to be restored. And so at First Pres, we've looked a lot at issues of justice, not only for humanity, for people who are working in the fields, but also what does that look like for the earth itself to be restored. One of the things we did in the food and faith class was to have people in the pews who are also part-time farmers or part-time laborers or part-time workers come in and talk to us about what it means to not only experience their faith, their Christian faith, with their hands as they pray on Sundays, but with their hands as they work in the fields. We had someone come in and break eggs and break bread with us to talk about the tangible aspects of our faith. One of the ways that we seek to address issues of workers' and farmers' rights at First Pres, similar to what they're doing at the UU Church, is by selling fair trade coffee and serving it at our congregational's coffee hour each week. This is one step that we're taking to try and create more loving and just relationships with the farmers and people who are working to produce the food and the coffee that we're drinking at our fellowship events. In addition to that, we also try to address issues of hunger by being involved in the local community. Each first Sunday of the month, we have communion, which is for us a sacred ritual, where we come forward to eat at one table and to share in Christ's body. On those Sundays, one of my favorite moments is watching people walk up the pews with bags of food to distribute to local organizations and food pantries that are working to feed the hungry. For us, that's an opportunity to not only be fed as a faith community, but to reach out to others and extend hospitality and love. One of the things that I think that we need to continue to do, and which I really admire about what the UU Church is doing, is to look at food justice issues on a policy level. That's something that we're still looking at and trying to learn about how we can not only address the immediate needs of hunger, but the larger systemic and political issues that are involved. At First Pres, one of the things that we'll be doing this spring is continuing to talk about food injustice through the ICPJ book study and through intentional conversations and Bible studies. One of the things that's been really unique is that we've had a good mix of people in their 20s and 30s who are bringing really unique questions about what does it look like to be people who practice their faith with every time they pick up their forks. People who are looking at questions of what does it mean to think about who we eat with, who we see, who we don't see, and to be willing to listen and learn to the people who are around us. So I'm grateful to have had that opportunity, and I look forward to continued conversation.
Thank you so much. In her remarks, Reverend Riegel mentioned the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice book study. There is a book that really fits in well with the themes we're talking about today of how do we hear from different traditions. What do the different faith teachings have that helps us understand this connection between food and justice and the environment? The book is called Faith and Food. My understanding is that the library is procuring some copies. A Literati bookstore is picking up some copies. We've got some copies that we can loan out. It's a fantastic book to be able to to read it by yourself, to be able to discuss within your congregation if you're a member of a faith community, within your book group if you're a part of one of those. And we have information about that on the back table. Also, both of our speakers mentioned that one of the really powerful ways to learn about some of these issues, sometimes somebody, you get the intellectual understanding, okay, maybe I should be doing things differently. Maybe I should be trying something else, but you don't know where to start. Both our speakers have talked about using potlucks as a chance to build community together and learn together. So we've got resources on how you can do that also at that back table. This is something that's a chance to not just develop by yourself, but also build relationships within your community and learn together. Our next speaker, I'm really looking forward to hearing from, his name is Mansoor Qureshi. He moved to Ann Arbor about 15 years ago in 2000. Professionally, he's a cardiologist but he also serves as the president of his faith community, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community here in Michigan. And so thank you, Dr. Qureshi.
Good evening, everyone. Peace be on all of you, and thanks for inviting me. This is my first time in this forum, so hopefully we'll look forward to working together. I was excited to talk about this because our faith, Islam, and the Quran talks a lot about food and faith, because Islam looks for both the physical development and the spiritual development, that they go hand in hand. If you have handouts, it'll be easier to use them, because I'll go through them, and I'm going to use purely the verses of the Quran to take you through some of this understanding based on the questions that were put to us. The first thing is the, if you have the slides, talks about the divine plan, meaning what is it, you know, we have been put in this world as human beings, and what does Quran tell us about how do we use the environment? And the first thing that this verse that I quoted says, have you seen that Allah has pressed for you into service whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth and has completed his favors on you both externally and internally? So again, it means that for human beings living in this world, God has given us everything for our physical and spiritual development, both externally and internally. And then it says, it is provided for thee that thou wilt not hunger therein, nor wilt thou be naked, and that thou wilt not thirst therein, nor wilt thou be exposed to the sun. Meaning, whenever mankind exists in this world, there will be enough provision for food, for water, for shelter, till the life exists. Finally, after all of this was created, God says, and when thy Lord said to angels, I am about to place a vicegerent in the earth. So man was then put in, as other congregations believe, in the mold of God Almighty. That now man should adapt the values and the way God acts and use them and to live in this world. And as at the end the verse says, surely we have created man in the best make. So now man is present and the provisions are present. The Quran then tells us, and remember also the time when your Lord declared, if you are grateful, I'll surely bestow more favors on you. But if you are ungrateful, then know that my punishment is severe indeed. So when we have the provisions, if we use them wisely, meaning we are grateful for the gifts that have been provided to us, and use them properly, and don't waste, then it will be an increase for us. So it will be increased. But if you're not grateful, then we could suffer. And then the next verse in that, it says, and when he, that means us, is in authority, he runs about in the land to create disorder in it and destroy the crops and progeny of man, and Allah loves not disorder. So when we are given the opportunity, sometimes we can create disorder. And when we do that, then God helps us taste that those issues, as sometimes we see the pollution and the problems. The verse says, corruption has appeared on land and sea because of what men's hand have wrought, and that he may make them taste the fruit of some of their doings so that they may turn back from evil. So if we begin to taste the consequences of what we're doing, then we have to realize that we need to turn around, and we have to understand what we're doing. Why are we not thankful to what we have been provided? There's surplus in one country or one area, and there is famine. We were talking about food. I grew up in Pakistan, and I saw kids picking up from garbage heaps. And now when I go to Kroger's, for example, there's a whole aisle of cereals, and I don't know which one to pick. So I've seen kind of both ends. But there shouldn't be despair. It says a verse of the Quran, so, O my servants who have committed excesses against their own souls, despair not of the mercy of Allah. Surely Allah forgives all sins. Verily, he is most forgiving and merciful. Now, going to the other question, if we have been given the responsibility, then we have to make sure that we deliver. Now we have been entrusted. God has put us as his caliph or subordinate or a vicegerent. One of the verses says, verily, Allah commands you to make over the trust to those entitled to them, and that when you judge between men, you judge with justice. So we use the qualities of justice, of wisdom, of mercy, everything that God himself has in our dealing with fellow human beings, and also whatever has been given to us by God Almighty. Similarly, they say, and they feed for love of him the poor, the orphan, the prisoner, saying, we feed you for Allah's pleasure only. We desire no reward nor thanks from you. And finally, in our dealing, we were talking about hunger and poverty, we have been asked that, and worship Allah and associate not with him, and show kindness to parents and to kindred and orphans and the needy, and to the neighbor that is a kinsman and the neighbor that is a stranger, and the companion by your side, and the wayfarer and those whom your right hands possess. Surely Allah loves not proud and boastful. So, in other words, those who are in authority and us as human beings, when we see our neighbors or in difficulties, we're wasting a lot of food and other useful resources, and we have to be very careful because there is a lot of need of it. So it's the proper use of the food that has been given to us, God Almighty, as the Quran has told us and other scriptures as well, that there's plenty, there's surplus. As God is just, so he has provided for us. He has put us in the world, but has given everything for us. So it is our responsibility to use it properly. The Prophet of Islam, and I'll just relate to you in response to the third question that was there, some of his recommendations about, we talked about, the question talks about the laborers and the difficulties and the farm workers. Some of the teachings of the Prophet, on him be peace, are give the laborer more than his dues, pay him what he earned before his sweat dries, meaning, you know, you pay him and give him as soon as possible. Do not put those under you to serve on tasks that you cannot perform yourself. As far as possible, feed your servants with whatever you feed your family. Do not transgress against the meek in any way, or you will be held accountable by God. Lest you succumb to false pride, occasionally make your servants sit on the same table with you and serve them. And so the finally, as my time is running out, I still haven't seen the stop sign. So our final thought is that Allah has provided us, so we need to use the resources properly. God has given us everything. I need to adapt. Instead of we, I'm going to say I. I need to adapt divine attributes of justice, mercy, compassion, and wisdom. I need to be careful about both my physical and spiritual health. I need to be watchful of both moral pollution and environmental pollution. Islam believes that it's the moral pollution that leads to all other problems. And my responsibility would be, need to be mindful of my duties as a vicegerent to Almighty God, need to be mindful of the rights of the fellow beings, take care in advancing both my moral and physical well-being, eat simple, eat moderately, avoid food wastage, and donate wisely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Some of you may be starting to have some questions, something you'd like some of the speakers to follow up on a little bit. We'll have volunteers and people circulating with comment cards, question cards. If you want to write something down, we'll be collecting those as we go and asking the panelists at the end of their prepared remarks. Our next speaker brings a variety of talents, a variety of expertise to the presentation. Carol Kaplan is a member of the Ann Arbor Reconstructionist Congregation and also the Jewish Alliance of Food, Land, and Justice. Prior to moving to Ann Arbor, she served as the president of the Reconstructionist Congregation in Evanston, Illinois. And as they did their new building project under her leadership, they made that the greenest house of worship in the country. She's continued that work. She's a Green Faith Fellow. We're having this conversation here in Michigan, but it's part of a broader national conversation, and the Green Faith Fellowship is helping people of a variety of faiths see this work of sustainability and environmental protection as essential spiritual work and working together across differences on that. She lectures on the crossroads between spirituality and environmentalism. She's a Wexner Heritage Fellow and graduated in the Chicago class of 2006 with that. And she's committed, she sees her work as this working towards a just and sustainable Jewish life, both locally and nationally. Professionally, her company, Live By... What?
I thought you were done.
Oh, I can be done. She also does this professionally. Her company's working on helping people access sustainable and environmentally friendly products from home filtering, cleaning products, and also in their own personal lives as a yoga instructor and as a Thai massage and bodywork practitioner. So she's bringing a lot of gifts. I'm really excited to hear how they all fit together.
By the way, you took 4 of your minutes.
I know.
I am so grateful to be here and to be partnering with ICPJ personally and as part of the Ann Arbor Reconstructionist Congregation. But I was thinking, I just recently was asked to sit on this panel to take the place of my colleagues who could not be here tonight. And I started to think that if we're going to talk about faith, it makes me think about heart, my heart and what I care about. If we're talking about religion, it makes me think about tradition and history. And if we're talking about heart and tradition, I end up thinking about stories and memories. And I think that makes it real to me. It makes it relevant. It makes it pertinent. So I'm going to begin with this poem. It's called My Mother Gives Me Her Recipe. It's by Marge Percy. Take some flour, like 2 or 3 cups, and you cut in the butter. Now, some women, they make it with shortening, but I say butter, even though that means you might have to serve fish, okay? And you cut up some apples, and not those stupid sweet ones. Apples for the cake, they have to have some bite, you know? A little sour in the sweet, like love. You slice them into little moons. No, like half or crescent moons. Are you listening? You mix sugar and cinnamon and cloves, and some women use allspice till it's dark, and you stir in the apples. You coat every moon. Did I say you add milk? Oh, yeah, just until it feels right. Use your hands. Milk in the cake part. And then you pat it in the pan. I like round ones, but who really cares? I forgot to say you need to add some baking powder. Did I forget a little lemon on the apples? Then you bake it. Well, till it's done, of course. Did I remember you place the apples in the rows? You can make a pattern like a weave. It's pretty that way. I like things pretty. It's just a simple cake. Any fool can make it, except your aunt. I gave her the recipe, but she never got it right. For me, if it doesn't seem relevant to your mind and to your heart, it won't be relevant to your hands, your actions. So when I think about faith and food, I like to go back to tradition and memories, so it'll be relevant for me, so that I can do the work that seems relevant in the world. And I encourage you to find your own stories and to do that too. In 1989, my father was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And out of the 7 types of brain tumors delineated at the time, only 2 were thought to be genetic, and 5 were thought to be somehow environmentally caused. When he died 1.5 years later at 57, I was left wondering what those causes might be. I was pregnant with my son, and as he was born, I had to stop and think, how was I going to live my life to reduce some of those environmental contaminants that perhaps were responsible for my father's passing? I went to cloth diapers. I started a food co-op. I cleaned my house and did my first green remodel in the early 90s, before green was green. It was just a color then. And I looked at how I lived my life, what kind of food I ate, what kind of food I was feeding my family. But something else happened for me as well. I started to think about faith and tradition. And it led me to look at Judaism in new ways. And although I was raised as a Reform Jew, I came back to Judaism after being a short stint with Buddhism, and also a longer journey in yoga and meditation and yoga philosophy. I came back as a Reconstructionist Jew, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I found that engaging with Torah, the text of the Jewish people, that the juiciness is in the interpretation, and certainly the meaning and the relevance is in the interpretation. And there were 3 questions that Torah asked. The first, everybody gets asked, where are you? And everybody gets a chance in the stories to answer, Hineni, here I am. So I became, the understanding came to me that I had to become present to life. I had to be asking questions. I had to be encouraging other people to become present and ask questions as well. And then when you go through the enslavement story, you get asked the question, who are you? What enslaves you? Who are you as a people? And where are you wandering? Where is your narrow and tight places, your Egypts? And what does freedom look like for you? And I began to think of what habits and patterns I was locked into, whether it was how I consumed things, how I treated people in my lives, and how our community consumed things, and how our community treat people in our lives, such as restaurant workers. And then the 3rd question that we get left with at the end of Torah is really, behold, I have placed, God says, I have placed before you both good and evil. Choose life so that you and your seed may live. So that in some way we can look at text as a calling to us to ask the question, what choices are we making in our everyday lives? And of course, that has everything to do with faith and with food. As a Reconstructionist, I want to read you this answer, because most people don't realize that Reconstructionist Judaism is about a 50-year-old endeavor to reinterpret and reconstruct text so that we might bring it relevant into this civilization. And the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, Mordechai Kaplan, had this to say, that Judaism is the evolving religious civilization of the Jewish people. And each generation has shaped the faith and the people through traditions that are ever being renewed and reavowed. So it's a chance for us to connect to tradition, but also to search for contemporary meaning. And it's a way to take a shared heritage and create a shared Jewish future. And this is the work, the project of the Jewish people moving forward. When we talk about it as religion, we talk about it as something that's helping us search for the ultimate meaning in life. When we talk about it as a civilization, we talk about how those values and those ethics might impact how we live our life day in and day out. I like to say that Jewish thought is the soil or the basis, and what grows out of that is our actions, thoughts and actions, in terms of food and land issues, food production, food justice, and food consumption. The Torah is very skilled at giving us both text and mitzvot, responsibilities or possibilities for how we might bring that tradition to life in our lives. There are 613 mitzvot, and many of them have to do with food, food production, food consumption, and how we treat each other and perhaps people who we see as the other in our lives. Shemitah is one of these commandments, or a series of these mitzvot, that is a commandment to every 7 years let the land lie fallow, and to take on a set of practices that allow us to see how we connect to our food and how land is used for food in many different ways. So this past year, the Reconstructionist Congregation and connection with Pardes Hanah have been working through the Jewish Alliance for Food, Land, and Justice to put on programming to look at how we consume our food and how we might do it in a more just way. So I encourage you, there's a flyer outside to look at more programming that we might have. And I'm, of course, out of time to tell you the good things we've done so far this year, but I look forward to being part of the conversation moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And as we'll make sure that if you didn't pick up a copy of that flyer, we'll be sending that out with as a follow-up to people. Hopefully we'll be able to get the slides. I know not everybody got a copy of those. I'm also hoping we'll be able to get a copy of the poem to share with people, because that brought back family memories for me, too. We'll have people circulating again just to make sure we get around for question cards, and we'll be collecting those initially during the last speakers and throughout the Q&A portion so that we can have that, we can get you involved in this last, as in the conversation as well. I got a little bit teased for the length of the last introduction, so I apologize, Julie and Colleen. I'm going to maybe abbreviate your bios a little bit. For our last faith tradition, you get a two-for-one special. We've got two people who will be sharing from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. The first one of these, Julie Ritter, has a long background in food sustainability issues. She was part of the beginning, 10 years ago, of the Food System Economic Partnership here in Southeast Michigan. She's done amazing work in the food industry, helping provide local food to people who maybe don't have the time to go and cook from the farmer's market every week. She's done preservation classes, canning classes. She's taught Girl Scouts how to make their own noodles. She's really gotten her hands, as the poem said, she's used her hands in this work. And also her faith. As a member of the Jewel Heart Buddhist Center for over 25 years, her Buddhist teaching has been a springboard for her commitment with the local food community. And she sees that a strong connection between those Buddhist values, the Dharma, the teachings, and food values and as going hand in hand. Also presenting will be Colleen Rutherford. She's been studying Tibetan Buddhism for the past 15 years, also with the Jewel Heart Buddhist Center under Gelug Rinpoche. She's not limited herself to studying within that tradition. She's also been trained by the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh and has done a lot within the Jewel Heart Center on their food and their faith and food program to help the community produce food that then they share with food gatherers so that the families in need in our community have access to fresh, local, healthy food right from our own communities and right from the faith communities that are here in them. So now to our presenters.
Within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have the Mahayana path, and it's also the same with Zen and the Chan tradition in China. And that path has the what we call the Bodhisattva ideal. And the Bodhisattva ideal is the idea that we want to become fully enlightened so that we can do this for the sake of all beings. And that path, that ideal, is very difficult to achieve, as you can imagine, but the very base of it is equanimity. That's the very first step. And that equanimity means that regardless of what somebody or an animal actually appears to be, we know that if we may feel very close to them now or distant and not even know them, but you know, from either past lives or just the fact that of conditions, we actually have a connection with those people even though we don't know it at this time. So equanimity means that regardless of whether you appear to be an enemy of ours, because you know we speak of enemies a lot, you may have been our nearest and dearest, or maybe in the future our nearest and dearest. And so the idea of food justice begins there for us, is that there's not a question of whether you deserve food or not. It's a question of, do you have what you need at this time? The next aspect of that is interconnectedness. To know and fully understand the fact that I can't exist without you and you can't exist without me. So when we're eating, one of the wonderful meditations that we do is when we're eating, particularly a Thich Nhat Hanh system, you think about all the workers that work the land itself, Mother Earth, all the people that had to process it, bring it to you, cook it, and all of those things are what you're meditating on as you eat. And so for that, the aspect of workers' condition, and from my own point of view, having become vegetarian now because of the plight of not just the animals in the factory farms, but also the workers who have to do the kind of work of butchering and so on a karmic level, and also eating organic food so that the workers, again, are not exposed to pesticides. This is a personal responsibility I'm trying to take for the larger problem. And I do believe, and in general, this everything that we do personally, if it can benefit others, this is the Bodhisattva ideal. So that interconnection in terms of everything that we eat, and the reciprocity, the idea that we also owe everyone. We owe everyone our life. Our lives are based on what everyone has done that's come before us and what's going on right now. So that when we look at the question of, well, the meditation is that everyone has been our mother at some point in time. Because, again, it's from a karmic level. But even whether one believes in rebirth or not, the idea that you're responsible for each and every other human and animal is basic to the Bodhisattva ideal. So we desire to see all humans as being happy. In other words, meeting with what they, what would make them happy. And on a basic level, that's to begin with food, shelter, clothing, healthcare, all of those kinds of issues. Healthy food, not just calories, but actually nourishing healthy foods. And to be free from suffering. So that ideal of folks and animals being able to be free from the suffering, the fear of being killed, the fear of being hungry, the fear of war, all of those kinds of fears, freedom from fear is basic. So as we move up this sort of Bodhisattva ideal ladder, which I'm still in equanimity, that's actually a lot harder than it sounds, but it's the... There's this aspect of I will be the person that makes this happen. Not somebody else, but I will be the person that makes this happen. And so there's no escape. There's no running away from it. But it's a really large task. And when I sit on this panel with these, I want to go to everybody's place of worship now and visit you. But the commonality is striking here. The commonality of what needs to be done. I don't know how much time I have.
About
Okay. So that's the basis. That's the basis for where we came from, where we're coming from, and then Julie is going to take it in more the activity, the action phase.
Hello, everyone. First, I want to thank not only the Interfaith Council but everyone else here. I feel so blessed to be in the same panel with all of you. It's just a wonderful feeling. So thank you. I came to work in local food by a backdoor route. In 2005, James Howard Kunstler published an article in Rolling Stone magazine about something called the Long Emergency, which was the first time I ever heard the words peak oil. I read an article by James Kunstler about peak oil, and he had a book coming out, which I was compelled to go and buy and read, and it completely changed my world. I had 10-year-old girls, and what he was talking about, which is coming to pass as we speak, as the oil supply of the world is dropping in production, all the easy oil has been taken, and now we're having to frack oil and drill under the oceans, and there's a huge economic war going on over fossil fuels right now. I started to figure out what I could do. Since I had children, children seem to be a theme on this panel, what we do for our families, and then contribute to everyone else after that. And the making a local food system seemed like the most imperative thing to do, because so many other things are leveraged off of the food system. You have transportation, you have processing, you have all kinds of different things. 3 months later, I had the opportunity to start with the Food System Economic Partnership, which was a coalition of 5 southeastern counties to establish a regional food system through the Michigan State University Outreach Program. I worked with Mary Wessel Walker processing farm shares into edible meals for people that wanted to eat farm shares but were too busy to cook. I worked with Emily Springfield at Preserving Traditions, because one thing about local food is there are no local food processing facilities at this point, although we now have a Washtenaw food distribution hub started. So you have to do your own food preservation. And I taught a whole church group over 6 months how to can and freeze and dry and root cellar their foods. That poster down at the end is one of the teaching tools that shows the different acid levels of food that you can either water bath, can, or have to use a steam pressure canner. This is a map of the food shed, like a watershed. If you draw a circle about 100 miles around Ann Arbor, this is what you get. And Kim Bayer at one of the local food summits dubbed it the Moo Shed for Michigan, Ohio, and Ontario. So people here have talked a lot about how faith works. I have handouts out there. I don't think there were enough for everyone. Oh, stop.
I'm sorry, Julia.
That's okay.
I just want to quickly say, if you can do a 100-mile diet and try to eat food that's procured from within that circle, you'll go a long way to helping change the values that will embody the things that all of us up here are so committed to.
Thank you. I'm still really curious what the top up there is.
Oh, this is one of my teaching tools. The top is the food system. Everything from planting seeds through gleaning after the harvest is over. Gleaning is a really cool thing. There's lots of wild apple trees around Ann Arbor. You could go and get free food in the fall. It rests on the soil. The quality of the soil is the basis for everything, which is why soil erosion and organic farming are so important. And it's driven by your food purchasing dollars. So where you buy your food drives the whole thing.
Nice.
And I will be happy to pass this around.
So I keep thinking about the connection with kids and thinking how much fun my kids would have with that right now. So one question that occurred to me as I listened to the panel, we heard Dr. Kresha, you talked about do not despair, and you gave some Quranic verses that talked about that. But then I also heard Colleen talk about it's all on me. That was the Bodhisattva ladder. But still, one of the issues that sometimes I wrestle with, and I imagine some of you may have wrestled with, is this issue of looking at the problems, whether it's the 30% of carbon pollution that comes from our diet, or the scale of worker rights abuses, or the scale of hunger. Sometimes despair feels awfully tempting. Mm-hmm. What are some of the teachings or the practices within your traditions that help you face that despair and manage with that?
Go ahead. So I think based on the teaching, based on the guidance, as I mentioned, that we have enough in the world and we need to use it wisely. And if we see disparity, that's been brought on by our own actions. And I think we should take responsibility for that. The other thing is, if we do see there are people out there who don't have enough, we need to find ways to help them out. So whether it be in this community, we have, if you ask what you're doing, we have this Feed the Hungry program here in Michigan, and all over our community is running it all over the country. In America, people outside America don't understand there could be hunger in America, but it does exist. So we need to do that, as well as you've seen pictures and everything in countries in Africa where there is just starvation and children are dying. So we need to either donate or go out there as volunteers and help out and feed those who don't have enough, and they're dying. Young kids, little kids are dying just because of hunger. And when I see on this side my kids coming from school, and what did you do with your lunch? I didn't like it, I threw it away. And so I think that's the thing that we need to work on, to make sure we don't waste food. It's a provision given to us by our Creator, and if we're not thankful, it'll go away. So right now it is provided for us, but we have to be careful.
I'd like to answer that with what I was ending with when I stopped, because that's at the Unitarian Church, one of the things we say is service is our law. And so actually putting hands on, you know, feet on the ground and hands, in our case, in the dirt, is actually, you know, getting results, and that makes you feel better that you're actually helping out. I was saying we have this farm project, Food Gathers Farm Project, where we have donated over the last three summers. We have helped Farmer Bill donate over 3,000 pounds of fresh produce every summer, as well as between $1,500 and $2,000 that he uses his roadside stand for. So we are helping feed people in Washtenaw County, and you know, that's one way that we can do that. We also, our church helps with Alpha House, which I'm guessing a number of these churches do, and you take a week and you do a lot of things with them, but one of them is you feed the people. These are, I don't know if people know Alpha House, but it's a homeless shelter for families, and it's on Jackson Road, and different churches take weeks to help with them. And so providing food is a you know, helping with hunger in the community.
I'd like to offer something that's more for each of us as we think about how would you answer that question. The Jewish teachings give us two teachings to look at, just to not despair. And the first is from Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, and it says, God led Adam around the Garden of Eden and said, look at my works, see how beautiful they are, how excellent. See to it that you do not spoil or destroy my world, for if you do, there will be no one coming after you to repair it. So in this one sense, we realize that it is about us and how we live and the decisions we make. But that's balanced by, in the teachings of the fathers, this teaching that says, it is not up to you to finish the task, but neither are you free to disassociate from it. So you don't have to do any more than you can do. And you study and you learn and you experiment and you collaborate to see what you can do, and you do that, and it moves the project forward.
I would just like to quickly say, when I started in this process 10 years ago and I was talking to people about local food, they gave me a blank stare. And here I am on a panel with a whole group of faith communities and all you people here. So there is no despair, because things are changing, and they change when each of us changes.
Mm-hmm. I would add one thing. So each week during our services, we have a time of confession. And so one of the things that I think we're called to do, especially as Christians, is to confess the ways that we've fallen short and to understand the brokenness that we participate in and perpetuate. So I think that time of acknowledging our own limitations is a way to not give in to that despair, but to say we participate in the brokenness, but after that prayer is offered, we have an assurance of pardon and this idea that there's grace and that God is working through us and in us and in this world, and that we are empowered to engage in that work with God.
In the Buddhist teachings, everything is impermanent, which means everything can change. And that's the good news aspect of things. So there's nothing that's set in stone. And learning how to skillfully deal with conditions is one of the tasks that we have to do as practitioners. So.
Thank you. The next question is, particularly when we deal with some of the environmental aspects and the climate change aspects, part of it is engaging with the scientific community. The questioner reads that faith gives us a reason to survive, but scientists gives us the ability to survive. Yet sometimes people of faith experience what seems to be or maybe is a conflict between science, what they see as science and what they see as their faith. Do you see these conflicts in your own traditions? And if so, how do you manage them? Dr. Qureshi?
Not at all, actually. I think if God is true and exists, and if religion is true and it's come from God, and if we are true and if this world is true, then there shouldn't be any conflict between God's teaching and what we see. It is all, and that's the teaching or understanding from Quran that I'm answering, is that as we evolve, as we grow, as we develop, newer things are discovered based on the need and the divine plan. So, you know, we discovered computer and we needed it and we used it. So I and Quran doesn't see any conflict. It is the weakness of our understanding of various issues that we see that we find the conflict or inability to explain the questions that may arise. So if I dig deeper into the Quranic references, I can find, or we, the people of faith, can find answers. And I think we were talking about it earlier, that this is one of the biggest weaknesses that is keeping our young generation away from people of faith or communities, because sometimes we are unable to explain or give answers to their scientific questions. And I think for a living faith, for a living religion, we should be able to answer the questions. To me, as I see the Quranic teaching or faith teaching, I don't see any conflict between the religion and faith. If there is more specific question about an issue, we can address that.
The Buddha specifically said, don't take anything that I say on faith. Try it out in your own life. Bite on it like it's a piece of gold. Make sure that it works for you. If it doesn't, set it aside.
I just want to point out, I'm wearing a T-shirt of the 150th anniversary of the Unitarian Church of Ann Arbor, and it talks about, it says, reason and compassion in action, and we very purposefully came up with that because reason is such an important part of our faith tradition, and so we definitely have no problems taking scientific evidence into consideration.
And I guess I'll add the Reconstructionist view, and certainly I don't have the authority to speak for all Jews or even for all Reconstructionist Jews, but there is a teaching in Reconstructionist Judaism that the past has a vote, but not veto power. So it's up to us to go back and look at tradition, to look at what's been known before, to look at what we can know today and then make it relevant and useful in our lives.
In the same way, in the Reformed tradition, reason is understood as a gift from God. So ways to be faithful include critical and constructive thinking, which includes using science and knowledge and information to ways to better understand both our society and our world and our faith.
Many of the examples of how you've been working within your faith communities and how you see the acting on this concern around food and justice have talked about people's decisions within their own lives, you know, our own purchasing decisions to spin that wheel of the food system. What have you had success, and many of the decisions we make and the forces that shape our food system aren't just our own decisions. It's things like U.S. subsidies to certain agricultural products, other systemic issues. Thomas Friedman says, change your leaders, not your light bulbs, in terms of what this is going to take to affect climate change. Have you, in your work, have you found any lessons in engaging not just the personal level of change, but also some of these structural or social levels of change when it comes to food injustice issues?
When, I can't remember her first name, Secretary of the Agriculture Department, Kerrigan, took office, she started a new initiative called Know Your Farmer. If you go to the USDA website and type in Know Your Farmer, you'll find an unbelievable abundance of information supporting the local food movement. She was a renegade. She was put in there, and when she started to promote this, people came out of the walls of the USDA to support her, all these lifetime bureaucrats. One of the things, here's another book that speaks to this very much. It's called Fair Food. It's by Orrin Hesterman. He has a Fair Food Network. He was instrumental in getting the state of Michigan to use, I think they're called SNAP cards now, it used to be WIC cards, at farmers markets. And the Food System Economic Partnership put together that the first application of that at Eastern Market in Detroit, and now I think it's spread pretty much throughout the state, at least to the big farmers markets. So some of these changes can be made on a policy level if the people hear your voice, and if you continue to send in things for the new farm bill. I mean, there's all kinds of, the farm bill is really the place where a lot of these decisions get made on a national level. And if you go online and add your voice to the other people, it will make a difference.
I think I would just add, I think politics and some of these issues come together or pollute the problem. I think as far as the farmers and the workers, as one of the questions was also, you know, we need to deal them with on a human level rather than the politics and the immigration laws and rules can be decided by the politicians. But once I have a neighbor who lives with me or if someone is working, I need to be careful about what he eats and what he does and what his children, do they have insurance and health and everything like that. So in my opinion, again, this is an opinion that we should keep the politics and the laws outside of basic man-to-man, human-to-human interactions. So whoever is here helping me out, giving me food on my table, I need to be watchful of what they have been provided. So we should watch out for all those laborers and workers, where they may be.
On the more political level, in our church, we have a social hall after every service, and we have tables, and we have a very strong social justice group, and there's always petitions to sign for something. And so before the farm bill, we were signing petitions to encourage the farm bill to be fair to the smaller farmers. That was one of the big ones. So we do work on the political level as well.
The next question is, if any, what are your faith traditions, teachings on food and fasting?
I can take that on first.
Okay.
Because I just went through a long month of fasting this past summer. So I think, as you all know, I think fasting, some sort of fasting or simch exists in pretty much every faith tradition. And different shapes, different forms. In our in Islamic faith, there is this the mandatory, if you will, fasting, which is the month of Ramadan, which is a lunar calendar, which moves based on the sighting of the moon. So you have the 29 or 30 days of fasting. And just for the information, fasting or not eating or drinking is just a small part of this whole month. It's more of decreasing the physical food and increasing the spiritual food. So you spend more time in worship and charity and donation and all. but you avoid eating, and I think that helps in multiple ways. I'll keep my answer short. One of the big ones is the pain and the feeling of hunger actually does remind you and help you in remembering those who may not have plenty. And during the day when I'm at work and it's the lunchtime and should I go and eat, I feel what the others who maybe have only one meal a day would be feeling. So I think along with all of the other benefits, including the health benefits and other things, this is one of the important benefits in this discussion, is that you realize what hunger could be about. And that is why the charity and the donations that happens during the month. So that goes on for a full month. So, you know, one cycle a year helps us focus on this.
Judaism as well is big on fasting. And I would answer the same thing. That is about moving away from a physical orientation towards a spiritual orientation. So what is it to take away something that we all seem to be thinking about all the time? What am I having for lunch? What am I having for dinner? And put it on, what am I doing with my life? How do I think of things? Am I in a regular practice of gratitude and prayer and blessing? And what would it look like if I moved more of that into my mindset? But it always struck me as interesting that Judaism has as much to say about kashrut and the rules about what to eat and how to eat as it does about fasting and when not to eat. And they both teach you something.
There are quite a few differences between Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, but for lay people, there's a big difference between lay and monastics. But particularly monastics, they fast from, they cannot eat after noon generally. So they eat in the morning, and then after that noon meal, they don't eat again until the next day. That's a regular part of their life. Mm-hmm. So they fast for that period of time every day. And then there are different sects that you know, don't eat anything more that can fit in this particular bowl. They have a bowl. But speaking to what you were saying, too, is that the idea of eating at any time, of trying to detach from food, to not be attached, to not be greedy, so that the whole watching what arises when you eat, as well as when you don't eat, is extremely important as part of the practice.
I would say that fasting it sounds very similar to both Islam and Judaism, and the fact that it's a spiritual practice that is meant to draw you closer to God. It can also be done as an act of solidarity with other people. Something that can be done both individually as well as collectively as a community, as a form of worship and of prayer.
Oh, do we all?
You don't have to.
No. We don't really do that so much.
I
So I'm not sure if this next card is somebody who has a lot of experience either with community, working with communities, or a lot of experience with lizards, but the questioner writes, people often have the attention span of lizards. How do you keep the interest and engagement at a high level?
Do you want me to take that?
If you have the answer, absolutely.
I have no idea what the attention span of a lizard is. But keeping lizard aside, I think it is true, and we all know our attention span is decreasing dramatically. I think it's down to I don't know how many words are in a tweet you can fit. I think especially our youth, that's all they want to hear. They don't want any, or a two-minute video at the most. So it is becoming difficult. As you know, I'm a president of a community, so for me to teach and present writing that they should read and things, they are always trying to have as little as possible, and so that they can. So this sort of interaction where in common words, you can explain something, they like it. But if you give them 3 or 5 or 10 pages or listen to half an hour lecture, nobody's interested anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think that is involved all of us. The way the technology is developing, we all want to get as much information in as little time as possible. And there's, in fact, overwhelming information out there, which is making it difficult, especially for the young minds to know what is right, where they should spend time and where not. So I don't know what the question is intent, but I try to answer as best as I could.
I would like to say that repetition is very effective, whether it's a tweet or a Facebook post or a blog or a book. Just keep repeating yourself, and eventually it does sink in.
That's very true.
I would say something else, too, is many doorways or points of entry on an issue as possible, because people are going to connect in many different ways at different times, and you want to be available. I mean, ICPJ is, and Jane has come up with this fabulous programming. There are many doors of entry into exploring these topics and making them part of your lives and your communities.
I think you could skip the lizard part also.
Go ahead. Well, we were talking about fasting, and at our engagement table that we have, one of the things that gets people over to our table where we have information and we talk to people about what we, what's mindful eating and so on, is when we have our Sundays where we have the food samples, we get lots of people there. So that is, you know, conversely to the fasting, I don't know if it's Unitarians in general, but they like food.
I'll be happy to take care of them if they overeat.
Something else. I think that there is something about being succinct and being able to repeat the same message. But one of the things that was really unique and meaningful in the Food and Faith class that we did at First Pres was that we started with what people's questions were and to kind of meet people where they're at, talking about story. What is it that draws people to this issue? And then we were able to go deeper. So I think that there's both a combination of being able to be succinct and to keep the same repetitive message, but to also give people the opportunity to think more critically and constructively about these issues, to do the intentional reflection, so that when you are eating a meal, which most of us have the privilege of doing three times a day, if not more, that we're able to think about what that means. What is the intentionality? What is the essence that we bring to that meal, whether that's of gratitude or of hunger and solidarity if we've been fasting? I think that there needs to be a depth to that conversation as well.
Thank you. As we wrap up, I just wanted to give you a chance to share any last thoughts, reflections you'd had after listening to the other panelists, things left unsaid. How do you want us to, what do you want to leave the audience with today?
One thing I didn't have time to talk about is that we also support Growing Hope, and I just wanted to throw that name out there. It's in Ypsilanti, and they're a wonderful organization, and they have lots of opportunities to help them out for people of disadvantaged with food availability and that type of thing. But other than that, I'd like to say I feel so glad that I've been able to hear from various faith communities, and it's I've learned a lot, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
I also feel really honored to be up here and to be learning and listening, and I think something I'm taking away is just the good work that's being done by different people of faith, but with common values about care for creation, about caring for others, caring for the quote-unquote other, and looking at this work of not just being of us as individuals or individual faith communities, but as a collective. And I think there's great power and energy, and that's where I find the hope.
Yeah, I agree. I think coming together and learning from each other and helping out are the themes. I really like the sentence someone used, freedom from fear. And I think if we all work together and we are thankful for what we have, we can be free of fear of poverty, of hunger, of thirst, of violence. So I think it is the responsibility of the leaders of the faith communities to bring the people and congregations together and talk about the commonalities rather than the differences and the divides. So, you know, hopefully all of us will work towards that goal.
I, too, want to express thanks for being up here. It's just wonderful to find the places where we connect rather than even contemplate what our differences might be. I guess I would just want to say I didn't get a lot to talk about Shemitah, which is this year that the Jewish tradition is examining in terms of being critical about our food system and how it works and evaluating what we might do in the next cycle, which is a 7-year cycle, to do things differently. There's lots of programming happening, and I'll make sure you get the information to that. But I guess I would like to say I always feel this at the end of a conversation like this, that may we hold in one hand our traditions and our faith, and with the other do the real work to make the world something we want to pass on to our children.
Yes, and I would like to thank everyone here, and you know, knowing that every faith that I know of has a basis in compassion and wanting to end suffering of others and recognizing our own suffering. And I don't think we can really affect a change in the world unless we are all doing it together. I really don't believe it's possible unless it's across the faiths. So thank you so much, and especially to ICPJ for giving us the opportunity to do that.
Thank you, and amen.
Let's give the panel one more thing. We are reaching the end of our evening together, but as I see this, this is also a beginning. This panel was the kickoff of our Food and Justice year of programming. There is so much more to be done. So please, as you go home, let me ask you to do this. Next time you eat, whether you're one of the people like me who has more than three meals a day and plans on having a late night snack before I go to bed, or with your breakfast, take a moment before you share that, before you have that food. Give thanks for the hands that produced it. Give thanks for the earth that sustained it. If you pray, or otherwise just hold an intention that everybody have enough food. Let that food sustain you in that work, but don't let it stop there. It's not. We need to give thanks, yes. We need, for those of us who pray, we need to pray, yes. And then we need to work. I caught a reference and I'm forgetting the name, so I'll just pass it. So part of that work is continuing to learn, continuing to study. We have a spring program full of opportunities, so many great ways for you to get involved, whether it's getting in the hands, getting to the farms, getting to see the workers, studying together. Please get involved. You heard tonight from all of these different faith traditions and the different works, the different projects they're involved with. None of this happens without people like you taking action. None of this happens. The change that people talked about, what gives them hope, what gives, how they see the possibility for change, it depends on you. You're sharing your time tonight. Thank you so much. All of the activities you've heard, the programs that ICBJ is putting on, the programs that the other activities you've heard on, they can use your time. They can use you rolling up your sleeves and getting involved. I know somebody who directs a nonprofit organization, they could all use your money. Somebody said something about repetition. They could all use your money. We're not going to pass the hat tonight, but please consider how you can share your gifts so that we can make a better world together. I want to thank again our panelists. I want to thank the Ann Arbor District Library for hosting tonight's event. I want to thank our own Climate Change and Earthquake Task Force who helped get this ball rolling with this work. I especially want to thank Jane Pacheco, my coworker at Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, she has brought so much energy, so much vision, and so much hard work to helping make this food and justice programming take place. And just as we leave, I want to share a verse that's from my tradition, also from the Jewish tradition, from the scroll of Isaiah. There was a question about fasting. We talked about how this issue of fasting in our personal practice connects to some of these social issues we talked about. In the scroll of Isaiah, it says, "Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and to break every yoke." May our work together be fasting that sustains us personally, but also that helps to end the yoke of oppression and the yoke of environmental destruction, and have a world of freedom and peace and justice for all. Thank you for coming tonight. Go in peace.